Okay, so I'm looking at the universe from the infrared, and this is a very broad topic. So I've decided to narrow it down to something that I've been working on recently, and where actually most of the excitement has been coming from in the past 2 years. So I'll be focusing on the submillimeter regime. So let me just start by saying, introducing a few of the key questions that are existing right now in cosmic evolution. One is, what are the origins of the observed extragalactic background lights? Then, what is the importance and redshift distribution of active galactic nuclei in the luminosity of the universe? And with relation to the submillimeter, what fraction of the submillimeter light does in fact come from AGN as opposed to star formation? And finally, in connection with this, what is the star formation history of the universe? So as I said, the focus of this review is that in the past 3 or so years, our understanding of the origin of the far infrared submillimeter extragalactic background light has improved dramatically, and is now in fact possible to resolve out much of the background into the discrete sources that are making it up, and then to try to place these sources into the context of what do we understand about the formation and evolution of the universe. Now, the importance of the infrared in all this is that it really gives us a window into the dusty universe. And as we all know, light that is absorbed by dust is then re-radiated into the far infrared. And the Kolbe detection of the extragalactic far infrared background will be discussed in more detail in the next talk. But as you can see from this diagram here, the far infrared background and the optical background are in fact comparable. So it's very important to consider both regimes in order to have a full understanding of the universe. If you only study the optical, you're only seeing half of it. There's a lot more to learn. And this is clear when you look at what kind of extinction corrections people are having to assume when they try to extrapolate from their UV optical observations, as Kurt just mentioned, a factor of 7 or so, that's very uncertain. And in fact, the optical may be missing some sources completely. They're just so obscured by dust, you can't actually even see them in the optical. So we have to find out if those objects are out there. So let me start by focusing on what we know in the local universe about extremely dust-obscured systems. Just put this over here. So from the IRS Far Infrared All Sky Survey, there was a class of objects that were found that, in fact, emit more energy in the infrared than in all other wavelengths combined. At luminosities greater than 10 to the 11th solar luminosities, these systems, known as luminous infrared galaxies, or LIGs, are, in fact, the dominant population in the local universe, so much more dominant than, much more numerous than quasars and Seyferts and so on. In the very extreme case, with luminosities in excess of 10 to the 12th solar luminosities, we have the ultra-luminous infrared galaxies, ULIGs. And this is where the question, it's seen that these systems are typically advanced merger systems. So then the question is, well, what is the dominant power source? Is it massive starburst, or is it AGN? Now, these systems have a characteristic thermal dust spectrum, which can be described by a blackbody. I've illustrated that over here. So here we have some local systems, ARP-220, Mercurian-231. ARP-220 I'll call our prototypical ULIG system. And you can see this dust spectrum for these sources. And this is really important when you come to the high redshift universe, because that spectrum redshifts into your regime that you're sampling. And so I illustrate with this diagram, where we have the ARP-220 curve with the data, the black body represents this region of the data. And what you can see, if I redshift this system, so here is Z of 1, 2, 3, and so on up to 10, although the flux is dropping, this peak is shifting into your field of view. So here we have the submillimeter point, 850 micron, and you can see that you're sampling lower on the curve for Z equal 1 and much higher on this peak when you reach Z of 10. So in fact, at this point, all the curves intersect. So you are equally sensitive to objects at a redshift of 8 as you are to objects at a redshift of 1. And this is a unique aspect of the submillimeter. and clearly a great advantage in terms of trying to detect very distant sources. Now, when SCUBA came online, the Submillimeter Common User Bolometer Array on the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope, it was a great technological advance. For the first time, we had the sensitivity and area coverage to directly image a region of sky in the submillimeter. And what it has found, and over the past few years has established, is that there is indeed a new population of high redshift, very dusty galaxies that had not been previously identified at shorter wavelengths. Now, there's a number of different groups that have been working on this type of work. The general goal has been to obtain long integrations on fields that have been well studied at other wavelengths so that you have important information at other bands right from the start in terms of interpreting the data. So I'm illustrating here one of the first deep SCUBA fields that was taken by Hughes et al. Of the HDF proper. And the interesting thing to do is, of course, compare it with the optical image. So here we have a composite of infrared and optical data from our work of the Hubble Deep Field. And you can see this circle here represents the SCUBA field of view. So the most obvious thing you see from these diagrams is how few sources there are in this map compared to what you see in this source, in this map. And then, of course, the obvious problem becomes clear. How do you match up this object with its proper counterpart in this field when you have a number of possible different candidates for any given source? So the resolution on these maps is fairly poor, about 15 arcseconds, and that causes some problems in our understanding, trying to determine their nature and learn more about them. So two approaches were taken in these initial SCUBA surveys. The first was done by people in England, Ian Smale, Andrew Blaine, and collaborators. And what they did is they targeted massive clusters of galaxies with SCUBA, with the intent being that any distant sources that were lying behind the cluster, which are at moderate redshifts, say about 0.3, 0.4, those sources would be amplified and therefore easier to detect in the submillimeter. And it has other advantages as well, which I'll get into in a moment. One of the primary disadvantages, of course, is that you have to have a very well-established mass model in order to get the right magnification corrections. So you have to be very secure that you understand your system to know what the intrinsic fluxes of the submillimeter sources are. The other approach, which is what we've been doing at Hawaii, is to study blank fields. And so we've done work with the Lachman Hole, Hawaii Deep Survey Field, Hubble Flanking Field. Hughes has done Hubble Deep Field, and then Eels and Lilly et al. Have been doing the CFRS fields. So there's quite a bit of data out there now, which is good in terms of confirming that we're getting the same types of results and seeing the same types of things in different fields. So as I illustrated with these diagrams, the first thing you note is how few sublunar sources there are, in fact, out there. But the key point to remember is that the luminosities of these sources are much higher than what you get from the optically selected galaxies. So that's why they can be such a major component in the universe. That's why they're so important. So this is a rough table of some of the surface densities and luminosities, the comparison between the submillimeter and optical. On this side, I have the cumulative number per square degree diagram that we've now obtained from all these different observations. And the nice thing to note right off is that we are getting good agreement. The solid symbols are from our work. The squares are from the CFRS work. Triangles is the HDF proper by Hughes. And the circles are the Blaine et al. Results on the lensing clusters. So what you can see is that we have good agreement in this regime. And what you notice is that there seems to be a cutoff here around 2 millijanskys. And the reason for that is that SCUBA becomes confusion limited at about 2 millijanskys. So beyond that, the blank field approach is no longer an option for detecting sources at fainter fluxes. So this tells you one of the great advantages of doing the lensing approach, and that is that you are, in fact, sensitive to any fainter sources that might be lying behind the clusters. But you can see the data is very sparse in this regime. This is just one source, and this is just an upper limit. So one of the key points right now is to determine where this turnover occurs. You have an empirical a parameterization of these sources, which didn't actually take into account the Blaine et al. Point, but you can see there is good agreement. And it was actually forced to match the observed EBL. And so clearly, from this diagram, you can see that the bulk of the Sublunar population is coming from the one Miljansky regime. So it's very important that we get more data and be able to establish this very clearly. Yeah, so about 20 to 30% of the 850 micron background is now resolved from the blank field surveys at the 2 Miljansky level. The cluster surveys and some work that has been done with fluctuation analyses in the Hubble Deep Field find that the bulk of the submillimeter EBL can, in fact, be resolved to the 0.3 to 0.5 Miljansky level. And it appears from these types of diagrams that the majority of the submillimeter emission appears to be coming from the 1 Miljansky population. So now that we've actually found a population of objects, our next goal is to determine what is their redshift distribution, where do they lie in the universe. And once again, this is complicated by the fact that the resolution of SCUBA is quite poor, about 15 arcseconds. So it's very difficult to identify the optical near-infrared counterparts. Some early work that came out tried using photometric redshifts of candidate counterparts. But this type of analysis was questionable, first of all, because the counterpart identifications aren't secure. There's no way to confirm that you have indeed found or have the right counterpart to the source. And the other thing is that the way these redshifts are obtained requires making assumptions about spectral energy distributions. And we don't really know what the submillimeter population is like. So we don't really know that the optical SEDs are a good fit. So another approach is what we tried, is to go out and obtain spectroscopic data of a complete sample of sources. Now, once again, we decided that for this trial study, we would target the submillimeter sources that have been detected in the LIN surveys. And the reason for that is that the submillimeter sources are amplified, but in the same fashion, so are the optical sources. So they're much easier in terms of getting optical spectroscopy. They're much brighter in the optical. So over here, I have a mosaic of the likely optical counterparts to each submillimeter source in the sample. The circle is the submillimeter error circle, about 3 arcsecond radius, centered on the submillimeter position. This is probably really only reliable for the brightest submillimeter sources, and as you go to fainter, it's probably more like 6 arcsecond radius error circle. And then you can see the various sources that one could target in a given field, and our goal was just to go out and target whatever possible optical counterparts we could see for each submillimeter source. In some cases, you can see that there's, in fact, no optical counterpart at all to target. And that's a significant result, because what we found in doing our survey is that we could spectroscopically identify about 1/4 of the submillimeter sources. They were, in fact, bright enough to get spectroscopy on. We found 3 AGN and 1 starburst pair. And these were, in fact, all confirmed later at OVRO with a CO line detection. However, what we also found is that the majority of the sources had no optical counterparts to I about 26. So that is, a lot of the time when we would target a neighboring source, we would find no signature in the spectrum that would tell us, yes, you found the submillimeter counterpart. So there'd be no clear AGN signatures or no starburst signatures or anything else to say that we had found the correct counterpart. So in most cases, these counterparts are not, in fact, the right ones. So that leads us to the obvious question, well, we've got to find some other way to do this, because this just isn't working. This isn't good enough. And what turned out to be the next step was to look at the radio. And the reason for this is threefold. Galaxies in the intergalactic medium are, in fact, transparent in the radio. So when you have an observed flux density, it's proportional to the intrinsic luminosity. Furthermore, radio maps have sub-arcsecond positional accuracy and resolution. So you no longer have the difficulty of saying, oh, which of these counterparts is the right one? You have a position pinpointed immediately. Thirdly, locally, it is very well known that radio and thermal emissions are empirically tightly correlated. And I illustrate that here with a diagram from Cram et al. And it's thought to be due to the fact that both radio and thermal emissions are linearly proportional to the star formation rate. So here you can see the star formation rate from radio power and the star formation from 60 micron data. And you can see this very nice tight correlation. So at 1.4 gigahertz, the emission is tracing very recent, less than 10 to the 8th years star formation, and that's due to synchrotron radiation from relativistic electrons. So if this far infrared radio correlation, which is known to exist at low redshift, does in fact hold at high redshift as well, then we finally have a method where we can go out and pinpoint submillimeter locations simply using radio data. So to do this, we started with a very deep 1.4 gigahertz sample of the Hubble Deep Field and Hubble Flanking Fields taken by Eric Richards. And when he matched his radio data to deep optical imaging, he found that whereas most of the sources could be matched to fairly local bright field elliptical disk galaxies, there were about 20% of his sample that had, in fact, no optical counterparts, to have I about 25. So the obvious question is, well, could these sources be dust obscured and hence detectable in the submillimeter? So that is the goal that we set out with when we began a SCUBA survey, a targeted SCUBA survey of these optically faint 1.4 gigahertz sources. And I'll start by showing you one of the maps we came up with. It wasn't, in fact, a very successful method. To illustrate here with a submillimeter map and its corresponding optical map. So what you should note is that sources that were optically bright in the optical image did not, in fact, turn up in the submillimeter, whereas sources which were optically faint did. So there was absolutely no detections of the optically faint sources that happened to simultaneously fall into our field of view. But we did have quite good luck at detecting the optically faint sources. And this was very gratifying in that when we were doing these long 50-hour integrations of blank fields, we were getting 1, 2, 3 sources, and it just seemed like a lot of labor for not much output. Whereas when you do this method, we were sitting only 4 or 5 hours on each of these fields, and we were getting detections like this. So it's a very efficient method for detecting the bright submillimeter population. And so just to give you some numbers, we detected 5 sources to our fairly shallow 6 Miljansky limit, that's at 3 sigma. A fainter 6 source was detected in the very deep Hughes et al. Map. We also found 2 non-radio sources, which just happened to fall into our fields. And these sources could be particularly interesting. They could be extremely high redshift systems. We found no detections of the 31 of 48 optical near bright radio sources. So our targeted survey turned up about 70% of the bright submillimeter population in the surveyed areas. And in fact, similar type results were obtained by Smale et al. When they compared radio surveys with their cluster targets. So the conclusion from all this is that yes, the far infrared radio correlation does hold at high redshift, and importantly, most bright submillimeter sources are in fact optically faint. So when you're going out and doing these spectroscopic surveys, you have to keep that in mind, so you're not going to have that great success. Now the radio has another advantage, and that is redshift. If you can't get spectroscopic redshift, you've got to find another method. And what I'm illustrating over here is the ARC-220 SED. So here you can see our characteristic dust spectrum, and here's the synchrotron spectrum. Okay. And what I've plotted is an object at a redshift 1, where you would see it on this figure, and where what region of the SED you'd be sampling at a redshift 4. And the point to note is that as this slope is dropping, this one is increasing. So you have this contrast, these opposing spectral slopes. So because of this, we can actually use this as a redshift estimator. And so we've called this our millimetric redshift estimator, analogous to the photometric redshift estimator that's used optically. And so if I show you the ratio, you can see that the ratio is, in fact, rising extremely rapidly with redshift. So if you know both a submillimeter flux and a radio flux, you can calculate this ratio and then look on this diagram, you should be able to pinpoint the redshift for that source. And it's not terribly accurate. And let me tell you a little detail about that. This was first proposed by Curley and Young, and they've done some subsequent work on it, as have some other groups, to say, well, you know, how good is it for us to be assuming ARP220? I mean, should we be a bit more careful in this? I mean, there's obviously a lot of different ULIGs out there with somewhat different temperatures and so on. But what has been found from all these different studies is that, in fact, ARP220 is a very good template. What you do is you take unevolved local luminous galaxies and you place them at the redshift that you would be observing them for detections at 850 micron. And you can either do it through this flux ratio, 850 to 1.4 gigahertz, or equivalently what Curley and Young call a submillimeter radio index, which is just a logarithm, essentially. And as you can see on this diagram, Curley and Young in 2000 found that this was the, they took all these local systems and found a mean value, and it's a solid line here. And the dashed line shows the ARP220, the redshifted ARP220 values. So you see that they're very close. And these are, in fact, distant objects, and you can see that the distant systems are, in fact, falling quite well on these curves. And clearly, locally, the range is between these dotted lines. So your redshift estimates are good enough to say, yes, these sources are in the, say, 1 to 3 range or whatever, but they're not good enough to say, oh, it's a redshift 2.5 type thing. So. No. The fact is these sources are extremely dust obscured. You're not going to see them, most of them optically. You see ARP220 in the submillimeter. No, you don't. No, you would not. If ARP220 were at a high redshift, you would not see it optically. So what are you saying? You mean you're... I should point out that some of these objects, AGN, are not going to fall on your this is for star-forming systems primarily, and you can see that some of the AGN are falling below the curve. So there is, you could almost use that as a discriminator in some sense to say whether it's an AGN or not, but I think that's pretty iffy as well. So just to summarize the radio results, two different cosmologies. I've illustrated the ARP220 spectral energy distributions at various redshifts. So here's 0.2, 0.3, 0.5, 1, 2, 3, etc. And I've also done this for several different luminosities. So here we have an ARP220 luminosity. Here's a 3 times ARP220 luminosity and a 6 times ARP220 luminosity. And so what you can see is here I've drawn like the redshift discriminators Z of 1, 2, and 3. So you can see that all the submillimeter sources from our radio sample are falling between 1 and 3. Okay. also, I should point out that you're not really sensitive. The radio is a great limitator here because you're not really sensitive to higher redshift systems with these depth of samples. And the submillimeter difference, that's your limit there. So this is from the HDF proper. So since I'm out of time, let me just throw up my star formation history diagram and not really say much about it, except for the fact that at low redshifts, the optical is clearly dominating. But once you get to high redshifts, these are the points from just that radio-selected sample. And you can see that they are, in fact, comparable to the optical data. This is unextinction-corrected optical data. But if then, since this is only for the bright submillimeter sources, I have to apply a correction to the submillimeter in order to take into account all the sources fainter than 6 mJ. And when I do that, the points fall much higher on the curve, and you can see there's a huge difference between the optical contributions and the submillimeter contributions. So it would say that the submillimeter is far more significant at high regis than the optical is. Well, these are due to dust, but these are not dust corrected. The optical data, which are the open symbols, are uncorrected. They would plot them higher, but in fact, I mean, there's a bit of a question here. You can't, for these points, you could just sum them. You could just sum the optical and the submillimeter. But when you get to these points, you can't sum them because there could be optical contributors at the fainter submillimeter fluxes. So it's a bit tricky. But that's the final curve. So I'll stop there.
Amy, the question I have is, how do you know that your distribution function isn't being polluted by some lensing of very distant objects?
The radio sources?
No, the submillimeter flux distribution. I mean, there could be some of those sources could be amplified by lensing.
Right, but I mean, certainly in the blank field, there could be some, but I don't imagine it's a dominant contribution.
Well, I mean, have you analyzed that, or
no? I mean, I haven't taken into account any kind of lensing for the blank fields. No.
But has somebody analyzed what the probability of lensing is for?
Andrew Blaine actually might have put out a paper on that. I seem to recall.
Yeah, but whenever I hear him talk, he always emphasizes how the lensing really amplifies the background sources, and everything you see is lensed.
Is everything in the field is lensed?
No, I'm exaggerating.
Okay.
but I mean, it's a serious concern for me, at least. That is. Are you actually seeing a significant enhancement in intensity? So.
Right.
I hate this thing.
That's right. That's right.
1.4 gigahertz emission comes from synchrotron emission from supernova remnants.
Right.
So you wouldn't expect it necessarily to exist if you have an AGN contributing to the flux. Could you put an upper limit on how, you know, which fraction of the submillimeter sources is associated with the AGN?
Yeah. Well, all we know at this point is what we got from the optical surveys. We're about 25% of the sources in the lens sample did have AGN contributions. But our goal was to get Chandra data to see if we could see any correlation between the obscured X-ray sources and the obscured submillimeter sources. So far, there doesn't seem to be a strong correlation between those two. So it looks, I mean, it's still an open question. We don't know how much AGN contribution there is. But it's not jumping out as all the submillimeter sources being strong X-ray sources at this point.
Roger. Yeah, Amy, I was a little concerned about the magnitude of your extinction corrections out at Z of 4 and 5. In our work, we actually determine the extinctions for each of the objects in our field, and we find a couple of things. One, basically, is that at high Z, or Z, high Z here means greater than 2, that there is a far less extinction than there is in the Z equals 0 to 2 area. And in fact, when we correct for extinction on each of the sources, it only makes a small percentage change in the amount. Now, of course, in our field, there were no SCUBA sources. And in fact, when we do the predictions, we predict that we would not see any SCUBA sources. So is that large change simply due to the fact that you are taking a certain percentage of the optical and saying for every optical then I have n SCUBA sources that have such and such? Because when we actually do the extinction correction, we don't find such a large one.
No. I have a transparency on that, which I didn't get to. It's not actually an extinction correction that we're doing there. The way it works, if I could find, I did this the figure. Well, anyways, that diagram I showed you, the when I showed the Kant diagram, the parameterization. Okay, so we're sampling the greater than 6 mil-Jansky population, but we don't actually know what's happening at less than 6 mil-Janskys, but we have this fit, which we are quite comfortable with. And so because the submillimeter is independent of redshift, we're making an assumption, and that assumption is that the Z distribution is the same at all fluxes. So we're saying that we know the redshift distribution for the greater than 6 mil-Jansky sources. We know it's between 1 and 3. So we're saying that we can assume that at the fluxes less than 6 mil-Janskys, we have the same redshift distribution. And that's the only assumption we make. And then your correction factor falls out naturally just from the measured EBL divided by the light from the sources greater than 6 mil-Jansky. And we find that the correction is 11 to 15. So it's not actually an extinction correction. It's just saying how many of the submillimeter sources are we neglecting by only looking at greater than 6 mil-Jansky.
We should check, because I think there may be a discrepancy in our results, because I think we're seeing those fainter sources, and we don't get that same correction factor. So we're looking at 1.6. I think we do see some of these, and that's what we have to check.
No, this has nothing to do with the optical sources. It's completely independent of the optical sources. This is just based on the submillimeter EBL and the sources greater than 6 mil-Jansky. It's an incompleteness correction. That's right. It's incompleteness.
On the other hand, I think there may be a discrepancy between what you're saying and what Chuck and Kurt Edelberger said. But basically, did you have a correction source by source of a factor of 7 or 5 or whatever?
When we do our corrections, we duplicate what Chuck and Kurt have done. So we find the same numbers they do when we do our corrections. And
at redshift 3 and 4.
And then we go on out to redshift 6.
Okay, other questions or comments from Leo? Just wait for the second a little bit.
I was wondering if the sources are so doesn't shroud it, I mean the optical ones, the diamond break, for example, the question that Kurt was talking about. Mm-hmm. Would you expect to see some of them in the submillimeter?
Oh, I had a transparency in that, too. So I'm getting to finish my talk anyways. Yeah. So I would say, okay, it's an open question, what the overlap is between the submillimeter sources and the UV London Break galaxy. The main issue here is that people have been looking into this, okay? Various different studies have been done. The results are marginally consistent. Chapman et al. Did a study where they found, when they targeted the Lyman Break galaxies that they thought were most likely to be dust extinction and therefore most likely to be submillimeter sources, they were on average undetected in the submillimeter at the 1 sigma level of 0.5 mil-Jansky. Then Peacock et al. Used HDF work to look at the highest UV star formers in HDF, and they found that statistically they were detected at the 0.2 mil-Jansky level. So they would say about 25% of the EBL is composed of Lyman Break galaxies. So I would say that it's likely that at these fractional mil-Jansky levels, you do have substantial overlap with the Lyman Break galaxies. But that when you're coming to the dominant population at 1 mil-Jansky and greater, you're not getting any, or just a few Lyman Break overlap.
Does that tell us anything about the amount of dust extinction, maybe in the Lyman Break galaxy that we do see? In fact, you only see them at the 0.2
mil. Yes. Yeah.